I'm really sorry to say that I don't think that MPs will progress it until somebody dies. You know, at some point, a bit of masonry is going to fall on someone's head, or there's going to be a fire like there was at Notre Dame or recently in the South African Parliament. And then everyone will say, well, gosh, it's outrageous that nobody ever grasped the nettle and got on with this.
Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. We're back again with another of our interview specials, and this time we're joined by Hannah White, who is Deputy Director at the Institute for Government, where she oversees its programme of work on government, parliament and the civil service. She's got more than a decade of experience in parliament, in the civil service, including on the Committee on Standards in Public Life in the Cabinet Office, which is a slightly wordy body, and she also holds a PhD in human geography. Hannah's been a commentator on politics for quite a while, but she's actually just about to release a book, Held in Contempt, What's Going Wrong with the House of Commons. Hannah, thanks very much for joining us on the podcast today.
Pleasure. Great to be here.
Let's start with an obvious question. What is going wrong with the House of Commons, or you know, specifically what prompted you to write this book?
I think it was really a degree of frustration with what I observe in the House of Commons now. I, as you say, I worked for a long time in the House of Commons, and since I left there, I've been working on the House of Commons, researching it and working a lot with MPs and select committees. And yeah, the book's really born of a couple of decades of built up frustration about the low levels of public trust in the House and the fact that MPs don't seem very interested in seriously trying to address it. So you get MPs quite a lot in speeches in the chamber saying things like, oh, what must the watching public think of this or whatever. But that's just really a rhetorical device. And actually, you know, I guess in some ways the title of the book's misleading, because I'm a great fan of representative democracy and think it's really important, and the House of Commons is really important. And this isn't supposed to be just a big complaint about politics. It's supposed to be a book talking about some of the ways in which actually public trust could be increased if people put their minds to it.
Okay, so I mean, you've said a lot of these problems go back a decade or more in some instances. The first couple of chapters of the book do focus a little bit on Brexit and COVID and the effect that that had on the House of Commons. Would you say that the effect's generally been for the better in terms of governance standards, or do you think it's got worse throughout those two crises?
I think one thing has particularly got worse, and that is the attitude of government to parliament, which has been a longer term trend, but I think became really sort of exacerbated in the context of Brexit and the pandemic. So one of the things I talk about is in the book is about the government's approach to legislating. And my sort of complaint is that they increasingly treat sort of taking a bill through the House of Commons as very much sort of a tick box process. They're not really interested in the added value that parliamentarians can bring. They just want to sort of to get it through. And so they're increasingly bringing forward what get called in the jargon skeleton bills, which don't have much detail about the actual policy in there. So parliament can't get its teeth into scrutinising the government's policy intentions. It just gives ministers a sort of broad powers to do what they want to fill in the detail after the bills become an act. And that got really exacerbated by Brexit, because there wasn't enough time to legislate for Brexit. There was so much that needed to be done in the narrow window to get the sort of the law ready for Brexit, that government had no choice but to do a lot of these skeleton bills and to give itself a lot of really broad powers. And then that then got exacerbated in the context of the pandemic, because, again, government had to act really quickly, had to pass initially the Coronavirus Act, which gave them new powers. And then they did lots of things using secondary legislation, which doesn't get much parliamentary scrutiny. And my argument in the book is that I'm concerned that ministers have started to get used to legislating in that way, and that they really are not sort of getting the value out of parliament, which they should, in terms of parliamentarians being able to look at things in detail, look at the policy ideas, and really sort of give them a stress test before they become law.
Do you think now that ministers have got used to those powers, is this problem going to get worse over time, or is there any way that, you know, it might go in the reverse direction?
Well, I mean, there were a couple of reports from the House of Lords committees in the last month, really bemoaning the use of secondary legislation. I mean, I think there's already evidence that the governments, the ministers, have kind of got used to this and are doing it outside the context of anything to do with Brexit or coronavirus. So, for example, the national insurance increase to pay for social care, the legislation to do that was passed using emergency procedures in a week, with no real justification other than, I suspect, the fact that the government didn't really want to give their backbenchers a lot of time to think about it before it became law. So I think there is evidence that it's going to be a continuing problem. Parliament can talk about it and can kind of say, oh, you know, as the House of Lords has, we think this is a problem. MPs can talk about it and say they think it's a problem. But the trouble is, and this is a sort of wider theme of the book, because government has so much control over how Parliament spends its time and what the agenda is and how long they get to talk about different bits of legislation and so on, it's really difficult for the opposition or other or even government backbenchers to stop the government legislating exactly as it chooses. So I think it's time for a wider debate about this. It's actually in all our interests for the process of legislation to be as effective as possible, because parliamentarians often do pick up things which are wrong, you know, just mistakes, unforeseen consequences, just ways in which legislation can be improved. And we at the Institute for Government do quite often talk to ministers after they've left government. We do have a whole archive, an online archive called Ministers Reflect, which is like exit interviews with ministers. And one of the things they often say is, actually, you know, I now realise that the civil service and ministers are too focused on just the mechanics of getting a bill through. And they don't really think about, actually, sometimes Parliament can save government from embarrassment further down the line because they failed to take into account something which then has to be changed in the legislation. So ministers tend to admit that once they're no longer in office, but they won't do it while they're there. And actually, then the incentive's all around doing it quickly.
So that's kind of an interesting point. I'm sure you'd find a lot of sympathy for your proposals in this book and your solutions to some of those problems among backbenchers and people who want to apply that scrutiny. But is your impression that ministers notice these problems while they're working, or is it only something that they can fully appreciate once they've left office?
I think some of them, if they were honest, would admit it while they're in office. Because it's pretty rare to have ministers who haven't spent some time on the back benches being frustrated by their inability to influence legislation before they become ministers. But then they do, and I think the civil service definitely bears some responsibility for this, because, you know, the focus is very much on, you know, how can we construct a strategy which gets the bill through intact, essentially, rather than how can we ensure that everybody, you know, gets to have a say in a way that could make this the best piece of legislation possible. And I think one of the other things is, you know, one of the techniques that Parliament has for scrutinising legislation is something called pre-legislative scrutiny. So set up a committee before you even introduce a bill and get MPs and peers to look at it in some detail. And that used to be more popular, but it doesn't happen so often. They've just done it with the Online Harms Bill. But they tend to do it with sort of slightly more technical pieces of legislation. But actually, it's a really good way to allow MPs and peers to get their teeth into a piece of legislation before it's actually on the conveyor belt through Parliament, and they can make suggestions in slightly slower time. I'd like to see more of that sort of approach. And I think that ministers, you know, just feel that actually that's a distraction, and it means that, you know, this thing that they promised in their manifesto isn't going to happen quickly enough. And they really want to sort of, within the electoral cycle, make sure that, you know, before the next election comes along, they've done the thing they said they'd do, and there it is on the statute book. And I just think that can sometimes be a bit short-sighted, because actually you could end up with a better piece of legislation if you took a bit longer over it.
So as you kind of say, the reasons for why having slower, more scrutinised legislative processes, they're fairly obvious. You also outline in the book general trends about the public not having a great deal of trust in MPs and maybe even respect for MPs, although I'm sure there's a lot of nuance in those views you could go into. But you're effectively proposing to give MPs more power to have some scrutiny over what the government's doing. if you went and told that to the average member of the public, you know, whatever your conception of that is, do you think they'd be sympathetic to that proposal, that you give MPs more kind of power in that sense?
Well, it's interesting. UCL, University College London, did some research recently where they had a big, massive survey of 4,000 members of the public, and also they did a sort of citizens' assembly process, and they actually talked to 75, I think, members of the public about this, and they did find that actually when they talked it all through and the way it works, the sort of the weight of opinion amongst the public was that they thought Parliament should have a bit more power. And it's not just to do with legislation, it's also to do with, as I say, how Parliament spends its time, because our Parliament is really quite unusual in terms of the degree of executive government control over the agenda. Most parliaments have a bit more of a cross-party mechanism for deciding what they're going to do each week. And I think when you think about the fact that, you know, we have a first-past-the-post system, very few governments are in power with anything like a majority of votes in the country. There are a lot of people whose votes aren't represented in the government who are in power at any given time. And actually saying, well, you know, these other MPs who are there representing other views should be able to have an input. I'm absolutely not arguing that the government that's there shouldn't be able to give effect to its manifesto and get legislation through in the end, if that's, you know, that's its policy agenda. I'm just talking about the, you know, the purpose of having a parliament is really to make sure different views are expressed, that minority views get to be talked about, as well as the majority view getting its way in the end.
So what you've gestured towards there in terms of like the balance of executive power in Parliament, there's a famous phrase by Lord Hailsham that the British government or the British system of government results in an elected dictatorship. Is that a view that you'd sympathize? Do you think that's correct, or you think that's maybe overstating it a little bit?
It might be overstating it a little bit, but I think it is definitely the direction where we've gone in. And a lot of people, you know, fiercely defend first past the post because they say, you know, we don't want, you know, they look at the continent or places with, you know, which always end up with coalition governments, and they say, you know, they're always in negotiation and small parties get a disproportionate influence over the sort of direction of the government. And, you know, governments can't necessarily get their agenda through because they're spending so much time negotiating. But I do think the opposite problem, where actually, once you have any sort of majority, you can just bulldoze your way through, and you almost feel that that's what you must do because you want to show that you're a strong government. I think that isn't entirely healthy either. So I'm the book is really, you know, I could, and maybe my next project needs to be thinking about the voting system, which has such an enormous effect on our politics. But using, you know, as if you leave that as the status quo, the book is really about how to improve our democracy as it currently runs, and say, well, actually, if the executive didn't have quite so much power, actually, there'd be certain advantages to that.
So you mentioned representation in your answer to an earlier question, and you have a whole section in the chapter in the book about that. There was something that really a piece of research that really stuck out at me, which is that younger women are seemingly less bothered than older women about getting more female representatives. Why do you think that is?
I mean, I can't speak for all those women who were interviewed in the research, but I mean, yeah, the academics argue that in that piece of research, they sort of say younger women are less bothered, but need to be more bothered, because the evidence that they find is that men and sort of more the better represented groups tend to be less conscious of some of the disadvantages that face minority groups, and therefore less likely to talk about them in legislatures and so on. I mean, I think it's probably because when you're younger, you've maybe come up against fewer of the barriers which you might then find later in life are more annoying. So as you get older, you think, actually, maybe I've missed out on opportunities or had things which have stopped me doing things I wanted to do. And that becomes more evident to you the older you get. But that sounds quite patronising, and I can't say whether that's actually the truth. I mean, that just seems like a logical thing that could be the case.
Yeah, you also note that all-women shortlists have been quite important historically in terms of getting more women MPs, particularly in the Labour Party and also internationally. Why do you think that those have proved necessary is maybe too strong a word, but so, you know, important in terms of getting more women into Parliament?
Because without them, political parties haven't been very good at selecting women in seats where they will win. And if you look at the evidence from other countries, some form of either quota or all women shortlist are the things that work. Of course, this time round, next time round, it won't happen because of the way the legislation has been drafted. Labour can't use them anymore, and so it's going to be interesting to see how the Labour Party decides to deal with that. But I think that one of the observations I make in the book is that the gender imbalance in the House is very party structured now, because Labour has 51%, I think, of its MPs are women, and for the Tories it's only 25%, which then levels out, I think, at 34%. So the observation again that I make in the book is that actually, if you have a more significant Tory majority at some point, then you could get backwards in terms of gender representation in the House because of the disparity between the parties.
So is your view that without mechanisms such as all-women shortlists, you don't think the problem is likely to resolve itself then?
Well, I think that's the evidence. I mean, we've had 100 years of evidence, right? And it was only actually once Labour did this that they upped their numbers of female MPs. So, I mean, it's easier in the smaller parties because they're making slightly more granular decisions. But I think that does, the evidence seems to be that that is what made the difference. As I say, it'll be interesting to see what choices the party makes, the Labour Party makes in the next election. I guess they're getting on with their selections now, aren't they?
To change topic to the kind of HR culture, or maybe lack thereof, that you see in Parliament, there's obviously been this high-profile story of John Bercow having his parliamentary, you know, his automatic parliamentary pass not granted to him, although he, as he insists, he's still allowed on the grounds if somebody else invites him in or he can go as a member of the public. Looking back on, you know, the last 10 years and Bercow's role in the Brexit debates and all the rest of it, and with the, you know, now basically proven allegations of the culture of bullying that he presided over, What do you think his legacy is as the Speaker of the House?
Well, to go back to the diversity point, like, he certainly made some significant efforts in that regard and was very open to sort of women bringing sort of small babies into the chamber, those sorts of things, which I think will have had a really positive effect on perceptions of the House and the likelihood of slightly more diverse people considering standing for Parliament. I think that it's really unfortunate that his style and his approach to HR, as you put it, was really corrosive, because there was a problem with bullying and harassment more generally in the House, and it couldn't be solved while he was Speaker, because he was essentially thought by a wide number of people to be a bully himself, and the evidence was there, and the evidence has now been put out there in the public domain, as you say, in this report, which I think the more important thing that it said is if he was still an MP, we would recommend he was expelled from the House, which is the most serious possible sanction against him. Obviously, that would have had to have been agreed to by the House, but that was what the independent panel recommended because of the seriousness of his behaviour. What they did was say he can't have a pass, because that was the only sanction they had against him left. So that's sort of not really indicative of the seriousness of the findings, I think.
Mm. The story is kind of indicative of the sense you get looking at the bullying scandal in Westminster, that MPs quite a lot of the time are marking their own homework on some of these things. And do you think there's a wider need for, you know, the House of Commons to be professionalised so that it represents a more conventional employer, for instance?
I definitely think that. I think You know, there are really good reasons why MPs are special in certain ways. They need to have a right to say what they want to say in the chamber without risk of being prosecuted. And they have, you know, abilities to do things that the rest of us can't do. And that's right, because they are elected representatives and they're part of the House of Commons. But in things which are just to do with being professional, running your office, you know, interacting with other people, managing your finances, all those sorts of things, Parliament really needs to up its game in terms of just making that super professional. Because I think that Parliament, rather than constantly finding ways in which MPs ought to be an exception to the rule because, you know, it would be more convenient for them, ought to be saying, well, look, everyone, we're setting these rules for all of you. We're setting laws on fraud. We're setting laws and regulations on employment and how you should, you know, treat other people and behave towards other people. And here we are exemplifying that and really like showing you the best, you know, trying as hard as possible to do, to be precisely within the rules. Because I just think it's really undermining of the reputation of the body that sets the rules to be the one that says, well, actually, but they don't apply to us.
Yeah, fair enough. So I don't think this is something you cover so directly in the book, but in the last couple of years, because of the increased use of social media by MPs and also by, you know, people contacting them via social media, there has been a lot more of a spotlight on the abuse they receive through those channels. And I think you referred to the Online Harms Bill as well, which is partly looking to address that. What's your view on how much can be done to actually... you know, to address the abuse they receive, because a lot of people would say that some of that is, or at least there's a blurred line between what is out and out abuse versus what is, you know, fairly robust public scrutiny, if we use that word. So how do you get that balance right in your view?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on social media and what the possibilities are really in terms of regulating it. I mean, I do think, and the evidence is there, that it puts people off standing for Parliament. And I think, and in particular, certain sort of minorities, but also just types of people, I think in terms of their approach, you know, people of any sort of characteristics, I think, you know, you now have to be really thick skinned to stand for Parliament. And, you know, the abuse you will receive is just a given. And I'm not sure that I necessarily want to be governed by a set of people who are just all really thick-skinned people who, you know, either, you know, who are so determined that, you know, that they want to be there in the House of Commons, that they're prepared to put up with this and they're prepared to put their families through it and they're prepared to suffer that sort of abuse. That's just a certain set of people. Are they the sorts of people, you know, just people like that, setting all our laws for us, is going to give us a certain, you know, way in which the country is run. And I'm not sure that's necessarily good for any of us. So I think it's a big problem. I don't know what the answer is in terms of addressing it. And you're right that, you know, there's always a balance between robust political debate and abuse. I do think anonymity online is a problem, because, you know, I've seen repeatedly myself that when people are able to sort of make comments, say at, you know, online events or below the line on newspaper articles, if you can do it anonymously, you're prepared to say things you might not be prepared to say if you had to put your name to them. But I don't know how you get around that technically.
So there was something else interesting that you said, and this goes back to your point about female representation in Parliament, that I think you said over the decades, as more women have come into the Commons, it has changed the culture. You know, I mean, this is slightly stereotypical, I guess, but, you know, it, in some ways, you argue it's become less of an adversarial, you know, maybe slightly macho culture of direct sort of competition, maybe something a little bit more conciliatory. Do you think that, I suppose you think that's a good thing, and it kind of ties in with what you said about, you know, not having a parliament purely composed of thick-skinned people?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's just about sort of conciliatory style. It's also about the issues that women raise. I mean, Harriet Harman's talked a lot about this and how, you know, she would just raise issues around childcare and, you know, part-time working and things which tend to be issues which women, you know, have an interest in. Obviously, men do too, and increasingly. But just the things that are put on the table by more diverse people in Parliament. You know, yes, absolutely, a man can raise issues about, you know, gender equality and childcare and whatever. But they are more, you are just always more likely to raise things which relate to your lived experience. And so the further we can get towards people with a wide range of lived experience in Parliament, for me, the better. Because, as I say, you know, it's not that you might not be really well-intentioned and wanting to represent all the views of everyone in your constituency, but it's just it's natural that the things that you experience yourself, you feel a bit more keenly, I think, and you're more likely to raise them. So I think the evidence is that as Parliament has got more diverse, a wider range of things have been discussed. Obviously, societal norms come into that a bit as well, in that, you know, there's just more things that are more openly discussed. You know, there have been debates recently in the last few years in Parliament about childhood bereavement and suicide and sorts of things that maybe in sort of decades gone by just wouldn't have been discussed. But it also, I think, is to do with diversity. And that's why I think also, you know, people looking at Parliament, I think, want to see people who they think are like them, because it gives a greater legitimacy, again, to the work that Parliament does. If you're saying, here's a set of laws we want you all to abide by, if you think those laws have been discussed and put in place by people a bit more like you, you're slightly more likely to think, well, you know, maybe I should listen to that.
And relating to getting as diverse a range of people into Parliament is the issue of how fusty, and you use the word arcane, a lot of its procedures and practices are. I mean, it's always struck me as very strange that members don't of the House don't refer to each other by name. They refer to the member for Sutton and Carshalton or whatever. To me, it's just obvious that you should change that and make the language a little bit more accessible. But why do you think that, you know, MPs seem quite reluctant to do that for the most part?
So that specific one, I think, is the line is that if you are calling people by name, you are personalising debate. You're more likely to get into a sort of yaboo type, you know, sort of type debate where you're sort of throwing insults at each other. And also the reference to the constituency is a reminder to everyone that everyone is there in a representative capacity, and that it's not, you know, you're there talking on behalf of your constituents, not in a personal capacity. But I completely agree with you. Like, that's the rationale. That's what people will say to you. I think it's just crazy that someone who gets as far as switching on the TV to watch what's being done in Parliament in their name has no idea who is talking to who. You know, you almost have to subtitle it to say, well, you know, when they say this, they mean, you know, this person. And, you know, that's just one of the examples, I think, of the way in which Parliament is really hard to understand. And it's hard to understand for the public, it's hard to understand for journalists, and sometimes it's really hard for MPs to understand what's going on because the procedures are so complicated. And you need people doing the job that I used to do to explain to them how the place is supposed to work. And some MPs are better at understanding how it works than others, and so they get an advantage. And I just think that's crazy.
So one of the most popular sessions from the public viewing point of view is obviously Prime Minister's Questions, which is, I actually think, is probably one of the easier sessions to understand. At least it's, you know, obvious that, you know, the Prime Minister stands up and talks for a bit, and then the Leader of the Opposition stands up and asks him obnoxious questions for, you know, 10 minutes or whatever. And I think even for the casual viewer, it's relatively obvious what's going on. You know, the Leader of the Opposition's trying to, you know, discombobulate the Prime Minister, you know, maybe a more straightforward word for that. But do you think that the conventional view is, obviously, it's terrible for public perception of the House of Commons because it's so rowdy and unprofessional, I guess. You know, people generally say you wouldn't see that sort of behaviour in most conventional workplaces. So do you think it's good or bad overall for the public image? Do you think it should change as a result of that?
I think it's really interesting. I think, as you say, it seems superficially obvious what's going on, although actually I think that there's no real accountability going on at Prime Minister's Questions. Actually, the Prime Minister is talking to his backbenchers and the Leader of the Opposition is talking to their backbenchers, and they are performing for the benefit of their own side primarily, rather than, you know, there's very rarely any actual accountability in terms of a question asked which really gets the nub of something in Prime Minister's questions. There may have been some exceptions to that over COVID when things calmed down a bit. I mean, I think it depends very much on kind of your own personal sort of view and approach to things, right? So I know lots of MPs who don't really like going to Prime Minister's questions because of the sort of aggression and the noise and the confrontational nature of it. And they say, well, you know, we can't all fit in the chamber anyway, so we might as well sit in my office and watch it. On the other hand, some people think it's really important to have sort of a robust session when the Prime Minister has to come before the House and has the possibility, you know, there is the possibility of him being asked a question, which really is very revealing of something that has gone right or gone wrong. So I do think public accountability, weekly public accountability for the Prime Minister is a good thing. I personally don't like the kind of barracking and kind of not listening to what each other is saying. I don't think that's a great example to show, but I accept that some people think that you know, that it's fine and that it, again, it's just part of a robust political debate.
The fact you mentioned that the, you know, the 650 MPs can't actually fit in the House of Commons chamber is a pretty good example of how the building, the physical building that's used for Parliament isn't really fit for purpose anymore. And you've got a whole chapter, I think, on how it's literally falling to pieces and, you know, needs a billions of pounds worth of maintenance works. And this has been resisted by MPs for many, many years because it would potentially necessitate all of them moving out, or you could have a kind of hybrid system where they move out parts of the building while it's worked on. There seems to be no sign of progress on that particular project. So what's your prognosis for how things are going to develop?
I mean, I'm really sorry to say that I don't think anyone will that the MPs will progress it until somebody dies. You know, at some point, a bit of masonry is going to fall on someone's head, or there's going to be a fire like there was at Notre Dame or recently in the South African Parliament. And then everyone will say, well, gosh, it's outrageous that nobody ever grasped the nettle and got on with this. But there just is no incentive on this. And I think for me, it's indicative of wider problems with the governance of Parliament and why things don't get better in some of the other ways that I didn't identify in the book. But I think there is just no incentive for current MPs to go through the hassle of having to move out, the risk that they might never sit in the House of Commons chamber again because they might lose their seat by the time the work is done. Their egos and their sort of self-perception as MPs is so tied up with the grandeur of the building. And they don't want to have to say to their constituents, this is going to cost billions of pounds. So they just push it off into the long grass. And the latest thing that's happened in January of this year was that a piece of legislation had been passed, a whole sponsor body had been set up, which was going to take the works forward, a similar model that was used for the Olympic Games, in fact. And it's all just been reversed, effectively. They've decided that they don't like the sponsor body because the sponsor body kept telling them that the only way to do this, you know, the cheapest, quickest, safest way to do this was for people to move, for MPs to move out completely and peers to move out completely and to just do the work. They didn't like that answer, so they've abolished the sponsor body.
And your view on what is going to actually prompt, you know, the Parliament to be restored in a satisfactory way reflects your view of a lot of the reforms you outline in the book. You argue that, you know, studies show that a crisis is often needed to actually prompt meaningful reform. And you think that crises are going to be needed to actually prompt reform of, you know, all the problems you've outlined in terms of legislation, representation and those kind of things. Why do you think that is? What is it about how humans run organisations that means that we need some acute crisis to actually lead us to actually make some changes?
Unfortunately, that's true, as you say. This fact is true of many organisations, but it's more than usually true, I think, of parliaments. And the trouble is, there is no single person in Parliament who can push progress on anything. The Speaker is actually doesn't have much power. There are endless committees. Every MP, you know, has an equal say, and no set of MPs can bind their successors. Like, the future Parliament can always undo what a previous Parliament did. So Parliament is peculiarly dysfunctional, I'm afraid. And one of my arguments in the book is that actually you need a bit more sort of lay involvement, public involvement in some of these mechanisms, because MPs are never going to, in the end, vote for things which aren't in the current set of MPs' interests. I sort of slightly flippantly at the end of the book say, perhaps because they haven't restored the building, perhaps it will burn down and that perhaps that's what we need. But to an extent, the evidence is, it was only the MP's expenses scandal which led to them sorting out their finances. It was only a bullying and harassment scandal which has led to proper processes for staff to protect them against that and have proper consequences for MPs. In the midst of time, it was only problems over electoral law which led them to sort of have to outsource those to judges. And I think at the end of the day, the evidence is that you might get incremental improvements, but with the government with having such a stranglehold over Parliament, it's never going to allow anything that to happen which isn't really in its interests. And MPs aren't going to let anything happen which they don't perceive to be in their interests, which leaves Parliament as an institution without anyone really advocating for it to say, well, what is in the best interests of Parliament itself as an institution?
That's quite a pessimistic note to end on, but it is the conclusion to your book, Held in Contempt. When is Held in Contempt out?
It comes out on the 19th of April.
And it's available in all good and bad bookshops, I'm assuming.
Indeed.
Hannah, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.